Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When it comes to water, says environmental explorer Fred Pierce, world maps no longer really tell the truth. As natural and complete as they may look in the crisp blue ink of an atlas, the fact is that today, dozens of the world's greatest rivers run dry long before they reach the sea, tapped out along their course by a voracious human appetite for water. The Yellow River, the Indus, the Rio Grande, and more. And then there are the wells, millions of small farmers with their little pumps sucking great aquifers dry. Oil gets the attention, but a global water crunch could come quicker, says Pierce. For many, it's already here. Up next on Point, new reports from where the rivers run dry and the world tapping out of water. We turn first today to Mexico City and the World Water Forum. Mark Stevenson is a correspondent for the Associated Press in Mexico. Mark, thanks very much for being with us.
You're very welcome, Tom.
So there you are in the convention hall in Mexico City. What's at the top of the agenda?
Well, the agenda is varied. As usual, many of these water forums turn into a debate over privatization, whether to privatize water or whether to treat it as a social good, a community good. And what we have here is 130 nations, 74 ministerial-level representatives, and they're coming together to talk about four or five basic themes. Water as a way to spark development, ways to improve better water access, to provide better water access for poor people, ways to better use water environmentally and for agriculture, and ways to prevent natural disasters that involve water, which is just about every natural disaster.
And as you say, privatization, a hot issue here. Critics saying there's stealth privatization going on around the world. What do they mean by that?
Well, the privatization debate used to revolve around the kind of things we saw in Bolivia, where a foreign water company would come in and buy up a municipal water system. That's still happening, but what's really happened under the surface is, even though some of those privatization initiatives have been turned back by public protests, we have a situation in which, de facto, water has been privatized throughout the Third World, and that's as a result of people buying bottled water. Their municipal systems give them water that they just don't want to drink. It's contaminated. It's not really drinkable. So they turn to the big bottlers, and with what little income they have, and many of them have very little income, they'll stretch that. They'll use 10, 15, or 20% of their income to buy bottled water. So in essence, the grand debate that we saw in the 1990s is moot now. Water has, for many people, you know, they already get it from a private source.
Mark, everybody's pointing to the irony of this water forum being held in Mexico City, a city, of course, built eons ago on a lake, but now with all kinds of water problems, disastrous ones fairly, of its own. Describe Mexico City's water dilemma.
Well, Mexico's water dilemma is in great part of its own making. This used to be a lake. It used to be a very beautiful, the first conquistadores talked about the beauty of the lake beds. Since that time, since the 1521 conquest, Mexico City has been trying to dry up its lakes while also trying to provide water to a population that now reaches 18 million. So you have a situation in which they have both floods and water shortages. They have a problem with sewage. They have too much sewage and they can't pump it out of the valley fast enough. This is a mountain valley ringed by mountains. So you have a Katrina-type situation in which the city has to constantly pump water out. If those pumps stop, we're flooded, and we're flooded with sewage.
Plenty of evidence for attendees at the World Water Forum in Mexico City right there in front of their eyes. Mark Stevenson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Mark Stevenson, an Associated Press correspondent in Mexico City. We are talking this hour about water and the world tapping out of it. Joining me now from London is Fred Pearce. He's former news editor at the New Scientist magazine and has worked as an environment and science journalist for nearly 30 years. He's traveled the planet and written up his global hunt for water in the new book, When the Rivers Run Dry, Water, the Defining Crisis of the 21st Century. Fred Pearce, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
You caught our attention right out of the gate writing that the World Atlas no longer tells the truth when it comes to rivers. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, I was, you don't have to go far. I stood on the banks of the Rio Grande at a town, little town called Presidio in Texas, and looked down and looked for the river, and it simply wasn't there. And this is a river, this is a town that's several hundred miles from the sea. And the truth is that you look on the map and the Rio Grande, it comes out of the Rockies and it goes down through El Paso and carries on down to the Gulf of Mexico. If you look at it on the ground, you get past El Paso and it simply stops. There's no water in there. Every drop of water has been taken out. And for about 200 miles, it's a few muddy ponds and it's an awful lot of salt cedar. And it doesn't recover until just past Presidio, where a tributary comes in from Mexico, takes a little water back to the sea. So what you see on the map as one river is actually two rivers, one that gives out at El Paso and a new one that comes in later on. And that's pretty typical of rivers around the world. The Colorado is not dissimilar. The Colorado, virtually no water runs over the border from the U.S. into Mexico to go on down into the River Delta. It's just all taken up before it gets there. Many other rivers, pretty similar.
And the point, I guess, is that everybody's got their straw in the river somewhere. The river's drained dry in patches before they can reach the sea. Fred, you've taken a world tour looking at this. Take us along on that tour. Paint some other pictures for us. The Rio Grande, we have a sense of. The Colorado, take us on around the world looking at rivers and what they look like firsthand now, not in the Atlas, but firsthand.
Well, I went to Central Asia. Now, this is the old Soviet republics around the Aral Sea. Mm-hmm. It's miles from anywhere. You find it on the map. Well, you'll find the Aral Sea on the map, but it probably won't look like the Aral Sea actually looks now. This was once the fourth largest inland sea, nearly as big as Lake Superior. Much smaller now. It's about the size of Lake Erie now. And it's been drained over the last 40 years. Well, it's not really been drained. It's just not received any more water because the rivers that used to supply it literally run dry. And they run dry because the old Soviet Empire and now the independent states of Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and all these kind of names that we've only barely heard of, they're taking so much water out to irrigate cotton crops. This used to be the great Soviet center for growing cotton. And cotton is one of the most thirsty crops in the world. You start growing cotton in a desert and you very soon run out of water. That's what's happened there. Huge ecological crisis, also a huge human crisis. You take a sea away, the climate changes, you get salt in the air, you lose your fisheries. There's a whole lot of very poor people there as a result of what was supposed to be a money-making enterprise growing cotton.
You stood along the Nile in Egypt, the Yellow River in China, the Indus in Pakistan. Paint those pictures for us.
Well, the Yellow River is, it's an interesting example of where, as in Mexico City, really, you have a drought and flood as a kind of combined issue. Now, what happens there is that the river comes down onto its floodplain, and for thousands of years, the Chinese have held it back behind artificial banks. They built levees higher and higher in order to keep the river from flooding across its floodplain. This is a very silty river. They call it the Yellow River for a good reason. It's the world's siltiest river. And the silt builds up on the bed of the river. So the river over thousands of years has risen up above the level of its own floodplain. So you stand on the banks there, and literally the river is 15 or 20 yards above the level of its floodplain. Now, that's always been a problem. Every year they have to build the banks higher and higher. Last few years, they've also been taking all the water out of the river upstream. Very little water comes down. Most of what comes down deposits its silt in ever greater amounts on the riverbed. Bed rises higher and higher. The capacity of the river channel gets less and less. So the fear now is that as soon as you get a big rains upstream and big flood coming down, that river is really going to burst out all over its floodplain. There's going to be one heck of a flood. Happened once before about 60 years ago and nearly a million people died.
Fred Pearce, remind us, we know what happens when the river runs dry, people get thirsty, but remind us what we're missing here. You went to Cambodia along the Mekong River. That's a river I've run up and down very happily, and it reminded you of what's lost when rivers run dry. Here's one that hasn't been tapped out.
That's right. I mean, well, the Indochina wars over the last 50 years or so have ensured that nobody really wanted to take a lot of money there to build a lot of dams on the river. So although the Chinese are starting to build way upstream now, basically, unlike most of the world's big rivers, this one is not substantially dammed. That means there's a big natural flood. Every monsoon season, a huge flood comes down. Mm. And that, if you like, fertilizes a huge natural ecosystem. It floods the forests. There are huge fisheries, nurseries, and so on. In some areas, the tributaries of that run into the Mekong actually back up. They go into the reverse because there's so much water coming down the Mekong. Floods huge areas of forest. This is where the fish grow. You have, as a result of that, perhaps the world's biggest inland fishery along the Mekong River in Cambodia. Cambodia is one of the poorest in dollar terms. It's one of the poorest countries in the world. Mm. In terms of how it feeds, it's one of the richest. They eat very well there because they have a lot of fish. And it kind of reminded me what the kind of thing that one forgets as you dam rivers and canalized rivers and you change rivers, as we have in most countries of the world, the kind of things that you lose along the way, and you lose that natural wealth, that natural fecundity, and the fish, you lose fish in a big way. So most of our rivers today are very poor imitations of the rivers that once there were, and the Mekong is perhaps one of the few examples just to show us what we've lost.
Fred, we've got half a minute before we've got to take a break here. You say we're living on borrowed time when it comes to water. Which runs out first, oil or water? Which is more endangered?
Well, I know which one I don't mind running out. If the oil runs out, we can get by. If the water runs out, we're really stuck. So worldwide, probably the oil will run out, but water will always be around because nature recycles it. The problem is having water in the right place at the right time where we need it so that everybody can get water. You can't live for more than a couple of days without water. You can get by a long time without oil.
Ken is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Tom, I would like to ask your guest, I'll take the answer off the air.
Sure.
I was in the Amazon watershed area a few years ago, and I was wondering if your guest has done any research in that area. Is that in danger? I understand that there are some stretches of the Amazon that are up to over 100 miles wide, and it dumps 64 billion gallons of water per second into the Atlantic Ocean.
So it looked like a lot of water to you, Ken.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Sure. Fred Pierce, how about it? The mighty Amazon, Ken says it didn't look endangered to him.
The Amazon is the world's biggest river by some way. They reckon about a quarter or a fifth of all the water flowing in all the rivers at any one time around the world are flowing down the Amazon. Mm. It's big. A year ago, the answer to this question, I would have said no chance the Amazon's going to run dry ever, and probably that's true. But in the last few months, back at the end of last year, there were a lot of reports, I don't know if you remember, of parts of the Amazon basin running pretty dry and people not being able to take their boats up and down the river. And that's the way everybody travels on the Amazon, by boat, because the river is the universal highway. But they couldn't, and there was not enough water to grow their crops and so on. So that wasn't true way downstream where the river is just so wide. But upstream, there were areas where it was running dry, and that was a bit of a wake-up call. Even the Amazon in parts of it can run dry.
Fred, talk to us about the big picture here. As you say, water is not like oil. Water is kind of, I guess at some meta level, there's a constant volume of it on the planet. Mm. I mean, unless it, I don't know, you tell me, but because it's always being recycled.
That's
so
right.
Is it all just about whether there's enough that's clean and drinkable and usable where it's needed? Is it just about where the water is?
I think it is principally. I mean, there are two areas of the world where there is a lot of water. There's plenty of water. Those are in the Arctic, the big rivers that flow north out of the Arctic, the Mackenzie River in Canada, and the Ob and the Yenisei and all these rivers in Siberia. These are big rivers, and they're flowing north into the Arctic. Unfortunately, not many people are living by them, so they don't have much use for that water. Much the same you can say of some of the tropical rainforest regions, certainly. So the Amazon, the River Congo in Africa, which is the second biggest river. Again, they're running through areas where there aren't so many people. So that's where the water is. Unfortunately, where the people are, there is rather less water very often, particularly in some of the more arid areas. And these are the areas that are coming under the greatest stress, not least because the people that live there need lots of water in order to grow their crops. They can't just plant them out in the soil and wait for the rain. They've got to irrigate them, and they use very large amounts of water to do that irrigation. That's where the rivers really do run dry.
Give us some examples there. You remind us that back in the 60s, we had this Malthusian nightmare in mind, the population bomb. Paul Ehrlich's book was out. That didn't happen. We got a huge population, and it's still living along, some places comfortably, some places not. So what's the problem now?
Yeah, I'm old enough, I'm afraid, to remember when the first great environmental fears came out. We wouldn't be able to feed the world's population. In the early 1970s, everybody said in the next 30 years, the world's population will double. There's no way we can double food production. Well, actually, the scientists did a pretty good job. They came up with what they call the Green Revolution, these high-yielding crops, so that you'd grow two, three, four times as much grain on a given field. What we never quite realized as they were doing that is the amount of water that they were you need in order to grow these crops, especially in arid areas. So what we are, 30 years down the line where we are, we doubled the world population. We also doubled the world's food production. That's a great victory, it has to be said. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, in doubling that world food production, we tripled the amount of water that we use to grow that food. So that's perhaps the bottom line of where we are now. So we managed to feed the world, but we emptied the rivers to do it.
The Green Revolution came with a high cost when it comes to water. You've got some remarkable examples in the book, When the Rivers Run Dry, about how much water it takes to produce the agricultural produce that we consume so blithely.
Oh, boy, the amount of water that there is in your shopping basket is just unbelievable. You buy a pound of rice. How much water does it take to grow that pound of rice? 500 gallons, something like that, 600 gallons for some. A pound of wheat, just the bread for your flour, now that's 130 gallons, 65 gallons for a pound of potatoes. You pick up a jar of coffee, a 1 pound jar of coffee. How much water does that take to grow that coffee? 10 tons of water. These are huge sums. And when you have to take the water out of the river and deliver it down canals and pour it over the fields in order to get those crops to grow, that's when we empty the rivers. We're just using so much water to feed a world population that's 6 billion, going on 7 billion now. Well, that's a lot of water.
So when we're eating, we're drinking too, and drinking in bigger volumes than we might ever guess. Robert's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm up here drowning in water. Minnesota has 10,000 lakes. People don't realize New York has 8,500 natural lakes. We got over 20% of the fresh water supply right here. But we've had a migration to the coast, lost a lot of population, and to the south because of cheaper labor, and now it's all gone to the Pacific Rim. But there's a big but to all this stuff. We're worried about the water basin level falling in the Great Lakes. And Canada has made it in the law, I understand, that there's no exporting of water. So that pretty much covers my comments.
So you've got plenty of water, but the population's moved elsewhere, and you're worried about the long-term prospects even right there. Robert, thanks for your call. Fred Pierce, how about that? Here's an example. The United States right now in the Southwest has had a tremendous drought. I mean, cactus dying from lack of water around Phoenix, Arizona. Robert's sitting there looking out at a lot of lakes and saying, what's wrong with this picture?
Yeah, I just saw a report a couple of days ago that they'd had their first rain in Phoenix for about 5 months, I think, something like that. It was the longest drought on record. Yeah, I think the way we live today, we often kind of think, well, we can live where we want, and we'll get the water there somehow. We don't see in the way that I think people did in days gone by, that, well, you go and live where the water is, where your basic resources are. We think, well, we'll live anywhere. If it's nice and sunny in the desert, we'll go live in the desert and we'll bring the water to us. So Phoenix relies for a lot of its water on the River Colorado, comes in from out of state along a huge canal, cost tens of millions of dollars to produce, to build. And, well, the Colorado is running pretty low now. There's less and less water in the Colorado each year, and we have more and more demands on it. So, is Phoenix going to carry on getting its water from the Colorado? Or, is Phoenix living on borrowed time? These are the kind of problems that we're facing. The Canadians, of course, he's quite right, are very jumpy about the idea of people from south of the border wanting to get access to their water, or indeed get the Great Lakes water, which, yes, they would say they share with the U.S. So they... They're very firmly opposed to that. They fear that a market in water could open up, that water would just become another tradable commodity, and that all their water would start going south. Now, actually, that's a slightly funny position for the Canadians to take, because they have more water than almost any other country in the world. They really do. But, you know, they're jumpy about it. They think it's our water and we want to keep it. And, well, you can understand that as well, I guess.
Fred Pearce is with us from London. His book is When the Rivers Run Dry. Fred, you tell a remarkable story about India, a country we really associate with the success of the Green Revolution. It's not hard to think back to when there was starvation there, and then, boom, lots of crops. But you paint a picture of India's aquifers being drained by legions of small farmers who have put their little Yamaha pumps to work and gone way down in the aquifer. Describe what's happening there.
Well, what's happening is in India, the rivers there have already run dry for much of the year. There have been water crises for river supplies for a long time there. So all the state-run irrigation projects, there's a huge amount of state irrigation schemes and canals and so on, crossing backwards and forwards across India, delivering water from these rivers. No water in the rivers, there's no water in the canals. So the farmers who are dependent on water to grow their crops through the year have taken things taken everything into their own hands, and they've started bringing in drilling rigs, and they drill down, and they, as you say, they get the Yamaha pumps and they stick those down and they start pumping away. Some states, half the electricity that goes into the grid is used to pump water up from underground. Huge amounts of electricity being used to pump up water from lower and lower down, because they're pumping much more water up than is being replaced by the rains. The water tables are going down and down. I went to areas in Gujarat, which is in part of the west, dry western part of India, and there are areas where 30 years ago, there are people who will tell you they remember that they could lift water out of their well just with a bucket. You know, it was 10 or 20 feet down, no further. Now they're pumping up from 400 meters. Now that's 1,200 feet, 1,300 feet down.
And huge
just to get
numbers.
Water to grow their crops.
You're talking about 20 million farmers doing that. That's a lot of straws.
Absolutely.
Stuck in the aquifer.
The last 10 years, 20 million of these pumps have been sunk. They reckon, now, I don't know if you can cope with this unit, I find it hard. They reckon that the farmers in India are now pumping from beneath the ground 250 cubic kilometers of water. Now, I can't...
staggering.
Los Angeles uses about 1 cubic kilometer in a year, something of the sort. So 250 Los Angeles full of amount of water are being pumped out from beneath the ground in India. The rains are putting some back, about 150 cubic kilometers. Now, that still leaves a gap of 100 cubic kilometers. India is feeding itself right now, but it's living on borrowed time and borrowed water. They reckon, one day... Well, different days, different places, that water's going to run out and India's going to be in serious trouble.
You call it a barefoot hydrological revolution. You quote an official there saying it's a colossal anarchy, a one-way trip to disaster. And Fred Pearce, you say India will run out of water in 10 years' time. That is a very, very near horizon. So much for the glowing Indian future we've heard so much about. What happens to a country like that if they really do tap out their water?
Well, India will start doing what China is already doing, which is, for the first time in their history, starting to import serious amounts of food. China has, as I say, for thousands of years, fed itself very happily. Suddenly it finds it can't do it. The principal reason it can't do it is it hasn't got enough water to grow the crops to feed itself. Now, that's fine. One country can do that, even maybe a country as big as China, the world's biggest country. But we can't all import food. Somebody's got to be producing that that food for us to buy. So, you know, we're hitting some hard times here. I think, you know, there may be technical solutions. I think the scientists, the crop scientists, the original Green Revolution scientists are going back to the drawing board. And they're saying, look, we need a blue revolution now, what they call it. Yeah. We've got to find ways of developing crops that are more efficient in the way they use water. They're not just super crops, but they're also super efficient water users. If they can do that, that'll help.
That sounds
also
great. Mm-hmm.
Also, the farmers are still, it has to be said, very inefficient in the way that they use water in many cases. Very often you can see it in the US, the same as you can in India. Farmers will simply flood a field in order to irrigate it. That's not the most sensible way if you're short of water. So there are a lot of, I'm pessimistic and optimistic. I mean, I'm pessimistic, I see how badly it's done and the damage that's been done. But I'm optimistic because I can see there's a heck of a lot of potential to do things better.
Fred, there's a lot of listeners who want to join us. Let's turn to Peo, calling from Rochester, New York. Hi, Peo, you're on the air.
I'm so glad that you brought someone to the, you know, to the topic that will fight forever to save Mother Nature. Anyway, I'm originally from the Dominican Republic, having living here for 42 years, but we were 16 kids, and we always collected tin roof water and filtered them, and all of us survived until the youngest one died, you know.
So you collected water off the rooftop, and where did you say you grew up, Peo?
In the close to the beach of the Atlantic, the ocean.
What country?
In the Dominican Republic.
Dominican Republic. So you collected rainwater to survive. How did
that
work?
From the tin roof. Yep. And most of the houses over there, you know, they are steel because it's a developing country. Most of the houses are tin roof, and they collect rainwater and filter them in two or three very clean, you know, clothes. Now, we all survived. We never got sick. Now, I live now, you know, here, and as a matter of fact, with the purpose of collecting rainwater, I changed the roof in our garage for tin roof rather than shingle.
So you're bringing a little bit of the Dominican Republic right there to Rochester.
But my wife doesn't like to drink the water.
Yeah. Peo, your line is rough, but let me put that to Fred Pierce, because, Fred, you talk a lot about what you call rain harvesting. Peo says it kept most of the kids in his family alive. Is that a serious alternative to pumps and rivers?
Oh yes, he's an environmental hero here. This is good stuff. It's happening all over the world. There's a kind of revolution going on. I think people are realizing that you can't rely on the water suppliers and the dam builders and so on always to supply water. Certainly not in the quantities that you might want. And we have to take a little responsibility ourselves. It's the easiest thing in the world to take the water off the roof of your house. You may not want to drink it. You might just want to use it for watering the garden or cleaning a car or whatever. But it's great, and it's happening all over the world. In India, we've been talking about India. The big new movement there is that villagers who are realizing that the rivers have run dry and the water tables underneath their villages are going down and down and down, and the pumping costs are going up and up. They're thinking, well, what other source of water have we got? Well, let's catch the rain. And they are doing it in a big way, and they're collecting the rain as it falls onto their fields during the monsoon season when, you know, they get all their rain in just a few days in India, so it usually just runs away.
But is that really another source? I mean, isn't that the source of the
source.
Rivers, essentially?
Well, yeah, but the trouble is if it goes into the rivers, then it goes into a reservoir, and a lot of the water evaporates from that reservoir. Oftentimes, it doesn't get into a river where there's a dam, or it doesn't even get into a river at all. It just sort of flows away somewhere and evaporates, or you just lose it. So what they're saying is, look, we want control of our own water. We don't trust the authorities. We don't trust anybody to bring water to us. We're going to collect the water ourselves. And I've been to villages where they've absolutely transformed their lives by doing that, by quite simple systems. Cellars under their houses sometimes to collect water, sometimes ponds out in their fields. Sometimes they collect the water and literally pour it back down their wells. They just hang on to that water so that later in the year, as I say, the rainy season there is pretty short, a couple of months. Later in the year, during the long dry season, they can pump up that water again and grow their crops. And it just transforms their villages. It's quite extraordinary to see it.
Peo, we can hear the sound of the rain on your tin roof in Rochester, and we wish you well with
guy.
It. I mean, that's very familiar to me, having grown up with a cistern that collected rainwater. We drank it. We seemed to thrive on it. And yet, there was always a limit. You know, if there wasn't enough rain, there wasn't enough water in the cistern, and things got tight. Larry's calling from Mason, New Hampshire. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a little confused. Maybe you can help me and many others that are listening to this program and also others that read about the articles concerning this. On one hand, we seem to be losing the water in the aquifers, the rivers, and the lakes. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, we seem to be worried about the ice caps and this level of sea rising. So we're drying up inland, and we are worried about water coming in from the ocean. Somehow, can't the two somehow meet the engineers or the scientists, somehow get together and figure out how to balance out the water around the world?
We hear it, Larry. Fred Pierce, what about it? Two very different sources there, but Larry's looking out at melting ice caps and asking, is there somehow not a solution there?
Yeah, it's not an easy boundary. In Saudi Arabia, they did talk about at one point about collecting icebergs as they came off Antarctica or maybe Greenland,
yeah.
and you know, towing these out to Arabia in order to use the water from them. I think the economics didn't add up, but I guess that's well, you could do it. You could do it. It's the icebergs would probably mostly still be there and wouldn't have entirely melted by the time they got there. Part of the problem is that as soon as that ice melts and it gets in the sea, it gets salty. And now, sitting here in the UK, when people talk to me about water, they say, well, why are we short of water? This, you know, we're surrounded by the stuff. We're an island nation surrounded by water. How can we be short of water? And the answer is, well, we're not, but it's salty water and it's expensive stuff still to desalinate. Uses a lot of energy and a lot of money to get that salt out of the water. So in practical terms, well, there are places, of course, where it's done. I think it'll be done more and more. I think in the U.S. you're going to start to see coastal desert cities in California and maybe in Florida and along the Texas coast, perhaps, who are going to start desalinating as the best way of either providing their main source of water or perhaps a backup supply. Certainly for drinking in cities, I think it's going to stay too expensive for irrigating crops with for a long time yet. So the technology is coming on, and I think it'll have a role in keeping some cities going. But you know, by and large, when water is salty, it's crazy to try and desalinate it if you've got some other sensible source of fresh water to use.
I'm looking here, Fred, at a report just about a month ago out of China with severe water shortages, saying it will turn to the ocean. It'll get about 50 billion cubic meters of seawater each year through desalinization by 2010. Two-thirds of the 660 cities in China, mostly located in coastal areas, now report water shortages, but they think they can get 20% of their demand gap between what they need and what they have from desalinization. But sounds expensive, as you say.
It'll be expensive, but they are talking about that. Tianjin, which is a city up in the north, which is very, very short of water. It's pumped dry. It's underground water reserves, and there's no water really left in the Yellow River, which is its other main source. So there, that's desalination plants are going in there, and I think along the coast they will do that. Again, it's okay for your tap water, where you know we're prepared to pay a reasonable amount to get that water, but the big volumes of water around the world are used for irrigation for growing crops, and there's no way that it makes any economic sense at all to use desalinated seawater for growing crops. Mm. So yeah, it can fill the gap in some places at some times, but it's not going to be the sort of bedrock water supply, if I can put it that way.
Ginny's calling from Birmingham, Alabama. Hi, Ginny, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. It's actually Judy.
Oh, Judy.
Okay.
Good to have you. Good to have you, Judy.
Thank you. Yeah, I've been listening with great interest. And one of the things that I wanted to mention, I've been a vegetarian for years. And, you know, I heard the speaker talking about the amount of water that it takes to grow crops. But nothing mentioned about the amount of water that it takes to produce meat. And I know that it takes over 5,000 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of beef. And I thought that was an interesting statistic that maybe, you know, I could share with the listeners. And also maybe get some comments from your speaker.
Absolutely, Judy. We've got it. Fred Pierce, there's Judy the vegetarian pitching in that if all you beef eaters would just settle down a bit, you might save some water. What about that? And I guess along that line, you mentioned how much water it takes to grow different produce different crops. Are there some crops that we've become accustomed to having that are just going to prove too expensive in water input terms that are going to get lopped off the top of that pyramid?
Well, I think that is going to happen a little bit. I think cotton is perhaps one of them. Cotton is generally grown in, because it grows best in desert areas where it gets more or less year-round sun, but it uses a lot of water. In desert areas where there isn't a lot of water, often it uses all the water, and that's not a good idea. Sugar is another one that uses a lot of water, and rice, of course, as you can imagine.
What about beef? Judy raises it.
Well, she's absolutely right. Beef uses a lot. But anything where you have to use water to grow fodder crops, to feed to an animal, to produce, whether it's meat or milk, she's quite right about those numbers. It's a lot. I did some calculations of my own. I figured I'm a meat eater and I'm a milk drinker and I'm a cheese eater, and I figured that every day, in order to keep me going, in order to keep me fed and watered, roughly 100 times my own weight in water was used. That was
every
my, if you like, water
day.
Footprint wow. on the planet wow. was 100 times my own weight in water. And then I did it for my daughter, who is a vegetarian. Mm-hmm. It's about half as much. So, yep, she's absolutely right. Vegetarians have a much smaller water footprint on the planet than meat eaters.
Very interesting. And yet, India is full of vegetarians, and they still have a water problem.
Yep, yep.
Abdullahi's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Abdullahi, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom, for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm from Somalia, and Somalia has two big rivers, Juba and Shabelle. I'm sure your guests would know them. They have been dry last six, on and off dry, last 6 to 9 years. And I would like to ask a question, your guests, and my answer, I'll take the off the air my answer. People are being cutting the they are cutting down trees to cook with no alternative methods available to them. My question is, with the tragedy going on, drought tragedy going on that part of the world right now, is there a connection between deforestation and dry rivers? And if it is, what can be done? Thank you.
It's a great question. Fred Pierce, I've traveled over that Somali countryside. It just looks dry as a bone and deforested, as Abdullahi says. What about his question?
I've never been to Somalia. I've been to Kenya over the border, and I've been to Ethiopia. I've not been to Somalia. But the short answer is yes. If you take down your trees, you're going to destroy soils, you're going to destroy the ability of the land to store water. And what happens in a lot of arid countries is that you do get rain, but you don't get it very often. And if you're not careful, it will just flood straight off the land, and it'll be in the sea, and the rivers will be dry in no time.
But once the forest is gone, as it is in so much of Somalia, what do you do?
Well, I get some more forest back would be perhaps
we've seen the big
the
campaign
solution.
For that in Kenya. A Nobel Prize came out of it.
Yes, indeed so. Wangari Maathai won the Nobel Prize just for doing that, for encouraging people to plant trees. It's not always practical. It's not always what you can do. I know in Somalia that there have been big efforts to, as we were talking about earlier, to harvest the rain, to capture the rain, not in soils necessarily, but to just however you can catch it when it does rain, and don't let it run off the land. And that seems to be a sensible solution. Quite often you build little, if you've got a little kind of gullyway where the water is running off the land, you build what they call a check dam, or just a sort of small dam to hold up the water, so that rather than running off, it makes the soils wet and perhaps percolates down, further down. And communities that do that find that the water tables rise, and they got more water in their wells, and they have a more viable source of water. So quite a lot of communities in arid areas do that kind of thing. And that's perhaps the most sort of sensible immediate solution. But if you can recreate the forests, you will, or encourage, in other ways, encourage the soils to be developed a little further so that they don't erode away, then that's going to provide a natural, or it's going to encourage nature to store water on the land. And that's probably going to be the best solution.
Of course, poor Somalia, just to get a government together, or a community together to do that, has been really challenging. Abdullahi, we wish luck to your Somali relatives there. Red's calling from Cape Cod in Massachusetts. Hi, Red, you're on the air.
Well, it's actually gray.
Gray. That's all right. It's one color or another. Good to have you, Gray.
One of the things that has bothered me is that EPA has kept track of the deterioration of the wastewater and water treatment infrastructure in this country. Now, this doesn't help the rest of the world, but we have hundreds of billions of dollars in arrears, if you will, of maintaining the water treatment facilities and wastewater facilities. And if we were to actually improve our infrastructure, we would stop wasting a huge amount of water.
In water treatment, in sewage treatment?
Sewage treatment and in water treatment.
You mean in producing drinking water, the chlorination and all the rest?
Well, the problem is that when you buy bottled water, you basically shift the availability of the water to those with more money.
Yeah, we can see that. Gray, let us look at that. Fred Pierce, what about water treatment? Is it inefficient? Are we wasting water in the process of treating it?
Well, we need to treat water. I think what we need to do actually is think about recycling water. Treating water should be a route to recycling it. We can put it back in the river and it does good in the river. Sometimes we probably need to use that water to irrigate our land. We spend a lot of time using very clean water to irrigate our fields when we don't, you know, we could recycle sewage, properly treated, pour that back onto the land. That would be a sensible way of, if you like, managing the natural water cycle in a more in a more friendly way for ourselves and for the natural environment. We need to be more creative, I think, about the way we think about water.
Fred, let me ask you about the privatization issue. It's a big one. We heard at the top of this hour in Mexico City this week at the big World Water Forum there. People say there's a stealth privatization going on. Mm. As Gray points out, once you have to pay for water, well, if you don't have the money, then you're cut off again. What about privatization? Mm. How do you look at it?
Well, I think we do. Whoever owns, I don't know, very often what's privatized is not the water, but if you like, the distribution system in a city or something. And if you do that, well, maybe if that private company is more efficient at managing the system, maybe that's not too bad, mm-hmm. Provided the regulatory controls are right. I think people get a little over kind of agitated about the problem of privatization. I think really that the sort of management systems that we have for water are just so bad that it almost doesn't matter who owns it. We're just doing it badly, whatever. excuse me. It's a hard one. I mean, we don't want to see water as a commodity which is just to be bought and sold. What, you know, we do have a sort of human right, if you like, to have access to a reasonable amount of water. One of the problems around the world is that about 1 billion people don't have access to clean water. And if we can find ways of giving them access to clean water, I don't really, at the end of the day, mind whether the water is, whether that's done by through the private sector or through the public sector. One of the problems you get in a lot of poor countries is that they announce that everybody has access to should have access to clean water. They say this should be happen very cheaply, so they set very low water prices. But then in practice, it's only the some middle class suburbs that actually get the water mains delivering water to their house. Mm-hmm. So the middle class suburbs get all the advantage of this, and the poor people living in the shanty towns don't get any water at all. And because the prices are so low, there is no method of raising funds to invest in better infrastructure to deliver the water to the shanty towns. Often what happens then is that whatever the government says, those people rely on water carriers, people driving trucks around, selling water to them almost by the bucket, often rather dirty water and certainly very expensive water. So you can get into a kind of cycle of creeping privatization of water, even when you have a public policy of public access and universal access and free water or very cheap water. So there's a lot of kind of hypocrisy in the whole policy of water. And I don't think we should get bogged down in, is it private or is it public? You know, the proof really is whether you can actually deliver water to people where they want it, when they want it.
Fred, I wish you'd finally, we just got a couple of minutes here, but I wish you'd take us underground. You write so vividly about the rivers that we can see and can no longer see where they're dried up, but there's fossil water, the aquifer water that you write about, and what's happening with it globally. What did you find?
Well, this is a strange story, really. The two largest reserves of water in the world, or underground reserves of water in the world, are both beneath deserts. Beneath the Sahara Desert and the Arabian Desert, there are huge amounts of water. But it's very old water. It's been there for thousands of years. It went down there when these areas were much wetter. And it's simply been sitting there in the rocks, in the porous rocks, for, as I say, thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of years. People are starting to pump it up now and using it. But this is, it's not like water which is replaced by the rains. These are in places where there is virtually no rain. Mm. So it's ancient fossil water, and we're mining water in these places. One of the most extraordinary ways of doing that is Colonel Gaddafi in Libya has built what he calls a great man-made river project. And he has used billions of dollars of his oil revenues over the last 20 years to sink great well fields in the middle of the Sahara Desert, miles from where anybody lives, hundreds of miles from where anybody lives, pump the water up and put it into pipes, pipes that are so big you could drive a truck through them, and take it to the farms on the coast to allow people to do more farming. So he's mining the water from beneath the desert and taking it to the coast. It's actually a hugely inefficient system. It makes no economic sense at all. And my own view is that in 10 or 20 years, these pipes will be empty. But it's, if you like, the biggest effort to try and use these fossil fuel, these fossil waters.
10,000-year-old water, use it once, and it's going to be a long time before that's replaced. Fred Pierce, you've trekked around the world and brought us quite an amazing picture, disturbing, but also signs of hope there, and we appreciate your report. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Fred Pierce joined us from London. He's author of the new book, When the Rivers Run Dry, Water, the Defining Crisis of the 21st Century. Listeners, you can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast, or subscribe to our daily newsletter, all at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.